The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading today from the September 20th, 2013 issue of The Week magazine. We start with the main stories and how they were covered. Obama agrees to try diplomacy on Syria. What happened? President Obama postponed a congressional vote on punitive military strikes on the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad this week, after an offhand remark by Secretary of State John Kerry paved the way for a possible diplomatic solution to the crisis. In a televised speech, Obama tried to convince a skeptical nation that Assad's use of chemical weapons in Syria justified targeted military strikes, but cautiously welcomed a diplomatic proposal put forward by Russia to avert a military conflict. That proposal stemmed from Kerry's exasperated comment during a press conference that Assad could avoid U.S. military strikes if he agreed to immediately give up all of his chemical weapons. "He isn't about to do it," Kerry added, "and it can't be done." But Russian President Vladimir Putin quickly announced that he would open talks with the Assad regime, a Russian ally, to hand over its hidden and scattered arsenal of chemical weapons. Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim agreed to comply to avert American aggression against our people. The president had been facing the prospect of an embarrassing defeat in Congress after asking for authorization of military action. In his speech, Obama said the U.S. had a moral and strategic interest in delivering a limited but painful military strike to degrade Assad's ability to deliver chemical weapons, and still should do so if diplomacy fails. "Letting Assad get away with violating international prohibitions on the use of chemical weapons," Obama said, "would be a green light for other rogue nations to make and use them." "A targeted military strike," he said, "would make clear to the world that we will not tolerate their use." What the editorial said. "What a fiasco," said the Wall Street Journal. "Obama is spinning this as a diplomatic breakthrough, but it's nothing more than a political escape route from a war he couldn't sell to Americans and never believed in himself. The end result will be that Assad will remain in power and get away with gassing more than 1,400 civilians to death. Obama surely won't risk another ramp up to war, given the opposition at home and abroad." Obama had little choice but to pursue Russia's offer to negotiate, said the Washington Post. "Neither Congress nor the American people supported strikes on Syria, and this offers the president a diplomatic get-out-of-jail-free card, at least in the short term. Right now, the offer seems like the type of head fake that Iran had used to protect its nuclear program," said the Chicago Tribune. "How can we trust Russia, Syria's main arms merchant, to get rid of Assad's chemical stockpiles? And how do we know Assad won't send some of his sarin to his allies in Syria or Hezbollah before UN inspectors arrive?" What the columnist said. "This proposal is just a stalling tactic by Russia and Syria," said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. "Syria has hidden its chemical arsenal in more than 50 sites, and finding and disposing of all of them in the midst of a brutal civil war would be nearly impossible. The U.S. began destroying its own chemical munition stocks 15 years ago, and it isn't finished yet," said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. "Russia and Syria are playing games, and when that becomes clear, Obama will have to go back to Congress or make decisions by himself." "Obama was still wise to take the deal," said Daniel Dresner in foreignpolicy.com. "It's a foreign policy gift from the gods, enabling the president to enforce the chemical weapons taboo without using military force and to evade a humiliating rejection by Congress. Even if Syria does renege on its commitment to disarm, the worst-case scenario would bring us back to where we are now, but with a better argument for military action. Diplomatically, that's still a win. We now know Assad is afraid the West will intervene in his civil war, said Robert Douthat in NYTimes.com. That probably means he won't use chemical weapons again. But the world now knows the U.S. has no appetite for military intervention, no clear strategy for dealing with the Middle East, and no serious plan to end the slaughter in Syria. Saving face is our only option now. The second main story, headline, New York's Liberal Turn. Liberal populist Bill de Blasio claimed victory in this week's Democratic mayoral primary in New York with barely 40% of the vote, enough to prevent an automatic runoff against second-place Bill Thompson, but not enough to avoid a recount. De Blasio ran a Tale of Two Cities campaign, promising to raise taxes on the wealthy and to end the police's stop-and-frisk tactics. His win was a rebuke to outgoing Mayor Michael Bloomberg. The mayor had been has been increasingly unwilling to address inequality in this city, de Blasio said, and this is the central issue of our times. Former front runner Christine Quinn, whose campaign never caught fire, came in third, and Anthony Weiner, torpedoed by a renewed sexting scandal, finished fifth. Joe Loda, a former top aide to Mayor Rudy Giuliani, won the Republican primary and will face the Democratic winner in November. In the city controller race, Scott Stringer defeated Elliot Spitzer, who resigned as New York governor in 2008 after a prostitution scandal. Economic liberalism in America is not dead yet, said Eric Alterman in TheNation.com. De Blasio's proudly progressive platform, including a promise to tax the rich to fund universal pre-K education, found broad appeal across the city. Liberalism isn't just reviving in New York either. In Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti recently won a mayoral campaign fought on similar lines. Could a change be in the air? Let's hope not, said TheNationalReview.com in an editorial. The last time someone of Bill de Blasio's bent became New York mayor, there were 2,000 murders a year, economic stagnation, and a general sense of ungovernability. Now he's proposing a multi-billion dollar mugging of New York taxpayers that's sure to drive off investors and send New York back to the dark days of the 1970s. Blame Bloomberg, said Reed Wilson in WashingtonPost.com. Though his name wasn't on the ballot, middle-class and low-income voters had grown tired of the billionaire's businessman's arrogant ways. The city's voters have also become fed up with a local economy in which the rich keep getting much richer while everyone else is struggling, said the New York Daily News. If Loda hopes to have any chance of winning in a heavily Democratic city, he has to figure out a way to address the voters' economic primal scream. In the briefing section this week, rethinking mandatory sentencing. States are rescinding laws that require long prison sentences for drug crimes. Why? What is mandatory sentencing? It's the automatic imposition of minimum number of years in prison for specific crimes, usually related to drugs. By design, mandatory sentencing laws take discretion away from prosecutors and judges so as to impose harsh sentences, regardless of circumstances. Mandatory sentencing began in the 1970s as a response to a growing drug and crime epidemic, and over the decades has put hundreds of thousands of people behind bars for drug possession and sale, and other nonviolent crimes. Since mandatory sentencing began, America's prison population has quadrupled to 2.4 million. America now jails a higher percentage of its citizens than any other country, including China and Iran, at the staggering cost of $80 billion a year. Is that a good thing? Most public officials, including liberals, conservatives, and libertarians, have decided that it's not. At least 20 states, both red and blue, have reformed their mandatory sentencing laws in some way. And Congress is considering a bipartisan bill that would do the same for federal crimes. Until federal law is changed, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder recently directed federal prosecutors not to introduce evidence that might trigger a mandatory sentence for offenders with no significant criminal history. Too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long, and for no truly good law enforcement reason, Holder said. Who came up with mandatory sentencing? It began in New York State 40 years ago in response to a burgeoning heroin problem. Wanting to appear tough on crime, Republican Governor Nelson Rockefeller created mandatory minimum sentences of 15 years to life for anyone caught with just 4 ounces of narcotics. The Rockefeller drug laws of 1973 were immediately controversial among liberals and drug reform advocates, who argued that they treated recreational users the same as hardened drug dealers. But similar laws were soon taken up by other states as governors emphasized tough solutions to the nation's drug problems. Michigan passed an even stricter 650 lifer law in 1978, mandating a life sentence for anyone caught with more than 650 grams of narcotics. In 1986, the federal government passed its own mandatory sentencing law. What prompted that law? The fatal cocaine overdose of Lynn Bias, the Boston Celtics' top draft pick, in response to the anguish of his Massachusetts constituents and to show that Democrats could be tough on crime too, House Speaker Tip O'Neill immediately pushed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act through Congress. Under the law, first-time offenders caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine would get a mandatory minimum of 5 years, while those caught with 50 grams would get 10 years. Anyone convicted of being involved in a continuing criminal enterprise to deal drugs received 20-year sentences, from the highest drug kingpin to the lowliest courier or lookout. Have the laws worked? Some law enforcement officials say they have helped get some major drug dealers off the streets and contributed to the steep decline in crime that began in the 1990s. But a chorus of critics say the laws have clearly failed to stop the flow of illegal drugs while filling jails with young men convicted of nonviolent crimes. About 1.3 million people, more than half the total prison population, are behind bars for nonviolent crimes. And federal jails are 40% over capacity. It's a waste of tax dollars and human lives, said Anthony Papa of the Drug Policy Alliance. Who are these prisoners? A majority of them are African American men. Although blacks represent only 13% of the population, they make up more than 50% of those jailed for drug convictions. Blacks are 4 times more likely than whites to be arrested for marijuana possession and typically receive sentences 20% longer than those handed to white offenders. The mass incarceration has hurt black communities nationwide. Among black children, 1 in 9 has a parent in jail. This ill-fated war on drugs has disrupted families, decimated communities, and rendered America's dark ghettos zones of desperation, desolation, and despair, said Ron Daniels, a lecturer at York College, City University of New York. What do reformers want? An end to mandatory sentences for nonviolent crimes, and a return to letting judges use their discretion and judgment in sentencing for minor drug crimes. Ohio, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, New York, and North Dakota have all reformed their sentencing laws, and California voters have rescinded the state's controversial three strikes law mandating a life sentence for a third felony conviction, no matter how insignificant the offense. Even the most conservative states are exploring new alternatives to draconian jail sentences. Texas, for example, diverted money earmarked for prison construction into setting up drug courts, electronic monitoring, and enhanced parole supervision for nonviolent offenders. The state has since closed three prisons, and the state's crime rate has fallen to its lowest level since 1973. Mandatory minimums are costly, unfair, and do not make our country safer, said Senator Rand Paul, who is co-sponsoring the federal legislation. The American people are ready to make sentencing reform a priority. Here's our good week for bad week for briefs. It was a good week for cheap labor. After several sadomasochists who responded to an ad by an Austrian woman were ordered to work on their mistress's farm, chopping wood and mowing the grass while wearing fetish gear. When the men realized they were being duped, they quit. It was a good week for salads in space after NASA announced it would send six romaine lettuce plants to the International Space Station in hopes the plants can provide astronauts with locally grown produce. It was a good week for thinking about inking after Washington, D.C. proposed a 24-hour waiting period before people can get a tattoo or piercing. Local tattooist Paul Rowe denounced the one-day wait, saying, "Overregulation is the killer of any profession." It was a bad week for Anthony Weiner, who finished fifth in the New York Democratic mayoral primary, and his wife, Huma Abedin, failed to vote with them or appear at his concession speech. His former sexting partner, Sidney Leathers, did show up to taunt Weiner, so he fled his own farewell party and gave reporters the finger as he drove off. It was a bad week for doing no harm after a patient sued a California hospital after she woke from surgery to find a fake mustache stuck to her lip and teardrop stickers on her cheeks. The anesthesiologist behind the prank said, "I thought she would think this was funny." And it was a bad week for excessive politeness after a Japanese man who had his phone and wallet stolen while visiting another city walked 870 miles back to his home. The 25-year-old said he didn't contact police or his family during his 11-day hike as he didn't want to make a fuss. Turn now to the best columns from the U.S. The first comes from Christian Carl, foreignpolicy.com. "We need to see war's horrors." "Do Americans really understand what war is?" asked Christian Carl. "Sadly, the answer almost certainly is no. How can we, when our news media shelter us from all but the most sanitized images of armed conflict? During the 9-year Iraq War, you could watch the news for days without seeing a dead or wounded U.S. service member. The government even banned photos of the returning coffins. Now, when the U.S. is considering military action in Syria, most TV networks and major news sites are once again engaging in excessive self-censorship. Few Americans have seen video of victims of the chemical attack foaming at the mouth or the dying children twitching on the ground. Nor have they seen the video of rebel troops coldly executing government soldiers with a shot to the head and dumping their bodies in a sewer. In war, unimaginably horrible things are done to human bodies. Things words cannot truly convey. Soldiers and civilians are riddled by shrapnel, shredded by blast waves, burned to a crisp. If Americans could see these nauseating images, they'd be better equipped to decide whether to undertake another foreign intervention." From Kevin Drum at MotherJones.com, how politics distorts our perceptions. Politics makes morons of us all, said Kevin Drum. That's the conclusion of a new study carried out by Yale Law Professor Dan Kahan. He tested the math skills of 1,100 participants, asked for their political orientation, and then asked them to analyze the results of a bogus study on a divisive political issue, whether a gun ban decreased or increased crime. Kahan gave half the participants data indicating the ban cut crime, and the other half data indicating the opposite. A strange thing then happened. Participants who had proven they could do basic mathematical analysis suddenly got really stupid if they didn't like the answer they got. When given data indicating that gun bans don't work, liberals with good math skills nonetheless said the statistics proved they do work. When given data indicating that gun bans do work, conservatives likewise lost the ability to do math and wrongly insisted that the data proved otherwise. The depressing conclusion: no matter how intelligent we are, when it comes to politics, we believe what we want to believe, and neither facts nor evidence ever changes that much. And finally, from Nate Berg at theatlantic.com, the Olympics should have a real home. Tokyo's successful bid to host the 2020 Summer Olympic Games will come with more than just international prestige, said Nate Berg. The city will now face the cost overruns, underused venues, and displaced and disaffected citizens that affect all host cities. Montreal spent 30 years paying off the $1.6 billion bill for its 1976 games, while Rio de Janeiro is currently dislocating 150,000 residents to make way for the 2016 games. Here's a better idea. Why not build a permanent Olympics venue? Public policy professor John Rennie Short has proposed designated an Olympic island, perhaps in Greece, where the Summer Games would be held every 4 years. Building one set of athletic venues would be far cheaper and could provide a stable background against which to measure athletic performance. Cities that covet the Olympics would object because they think the Games give them an economic boost, but the evidence just doesn't back that up. Only the Los Angeles Games of 1932 and 1984 have turned profits because they used existing infrastructure and facilities. Having a single location is hardly a new idea. The Olympics were held at Olympia for more than 1,000 years. Maybe it's time for another look. On the technology page, we have an article, Encryption. Are there any secrets on the web? Is anything online safe? Asked Larry Seltzer in ZDNet.com. Last week, a joint report from The Guardian, The New York Times, and ProPublica.org revealed that the National Security Agency had managed to crack many common forms of encryption used on the Internet, not just by terrorists, but also by regular consumers and businesses. The NSA's efforts appear mostly geared to get around the cryptography rather than to break it directly, often using black hat methods. The truly upsetting revelation is that the NSA is allegedly working hand-in-hand with tech companies to gain backdoor access, allowing analysts to sniff traffic on these sites unimpeded by encryption. Let's not freak out, said Sean Lawson in Forbes.com. The fact is that the NSA is not likely to want into your or my computer. The real problem is that other people might. It now appears that some common tools, like the encryption many companies use to protect their private networks and the 4G/LTE encryption used by wireless carriers, might be vulnerable to NSA intrusion. But such encryption can still provide protection against the more likely threat, which is a malicious actor in the coffee shop sniffing traffic and stealing personal information from other users. The key to personal internet security is to stay vigilant. It makes no sense to abandon tools that enhance your privacy out of concern over a ubiquitous adversary that is likely not targeting you and that you likely could not stop anyway. And there are plenty of such tools at your disposal, said Bruce Schneider in The Guardian. As long as you're using the latest software, the best encryption available, and a strong password, odds are your data will be safe, at least from the garden variety hackers that do the most damage. But if you're concerned, start using software like Tor, which anonymizes your network activity. Hackers and the NSA might target Tor users and others who encrypt their communications, but it's work for them. And by taking these precautions, you're much better protected than if you communicate in the clear. For the absolute highest security, break the chain of transmission with an air gap. That is, buy a new computer that has never been connected to the internet and transfer files only on physical media, such as USB sticks. And don't trust commercial or proprietary security software, especially from larger vendors. My guess is that most encryption products from large U.S. companies have NSA-friendly backdoors. Open-source products are much more difficult for hackers to secretly infiltrate or modify. For you fiction readers out there, here's the novel of the week. Mad Adam. That's M-A-D-D-A-D-D-A-M by Margaret Atwood. The world has rarely ended so beautifully, said J. Robert Lennon in the Globe and Mail. In the final volume of a trilogy she launched with 2003's Oryx and Crake, Margaret Atwood offers little in the way of new action, but still brings her singular post-apocalyptic epic to a strangely satisfying conclusion. Once again, the reader embeds with a small band of survivors who, in the wake of a global pandemic, are caring for a few childlike humanoids known as Krakers, who stand to inherit the world. But rather than staging multiple mortal battles, Atwood teases out some of the subtler ramifications of the scenarios she's devised. She miraculously balances humor, outrage, and beauty on every page, said Andrew Sean Greer in the New York Times, as Toby, our heroine, tries to explain recent history to the Krakers. Storytelling becomes Atwood's subject. The Krakers, like humans before them, must begin the project of building their world by embracing a beautiful fiction. We're going to pick up a few articles from the business section this week. This is the issue of the week, the real unemployment rate. Don't be fooled, said Neil Irwin in WashingtonPost.com. This was a very bad jobs report. The Labor Department's latest jobs data, released last week, looked deceivingly positive. The unemployment rate fell from 7.4 to 7.3%, and the economy added 169,000 jobs. But in almost all the particulars, you can find signs that this job market is weaker than it appeared just a few months ago, and may be getting worse. The only reason the unemployment rate dropped was because 312,000 fewer people were looking for work. And the department also revised its estimates of June and July job creation downward, slashing 74,000 positions from its initial estimates. In other words, through the summer, hiring has been quite a bit shakier than it had appeared. The unemployment rate has become an almost meaningless number, said Felix Salmon at Reuters.com. and it has never conveyed less information than it does today. We should be paying attention instead to the labor participation rate, especially since the Federal Reserve has explicitly linked its tightening monetary policy to employment. You can be sure the Fed has been given pause by the high number of discouraged workers who have stopped searching for work. Last week's job report was bad, no two ways about it. But at least now we know that it's too soon for the central bank to even think about tapering off its bond buying activity. The Fed says it'll start doing so if it sees a substantial improvement in the job market, said Ninhai Singh in Fortune.com. And while it hasn't given much detail as to what substantial improvement looks like, this surely isn't it. Companies and governments aren't shedding nearly as many jobs as during the dark days of the Great Recession, but they are also creating just enough jobs to keep up with the population growth. Nothing more. If this is as good as it gets, most Americans still have plenty to worry about. This certainly is a puzzling recovery, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Discouraged workers aren't unusual. In every recession, people drop out of the labor force. But once the economy picks up, they start sending out resumes, and the participation rate gradually picks up. Not this time. After 5 years, the labor participation rate is still almost 3 percentage points lower, at 63.2%, down from 66.1%, than it was when the financial crisis hit. If you counted discouraged workers, then the real unemployment rate would be roughly 11.3%. Yes, well into double digits. In part, this is because the structure of the American workforce is changing. Baby boomers are retiring, and the number of women going out to work has plateaued. But that's not enough to explain the current numbers. The participation rate hasn't just edged down, it's fallen precipitously. Structural factors tell only a part of the story. What we're seeing is primarily the result of a soft economy, which led many people to stop looking for work. A cheerily meaningless official unemployment rate offers them no solace whatever. Here's one of the best columns in the business. It's by Noreen Malone of the New Republic, The Wealthy Villains of Silicon Valley. There's a new set of rich bad guys in the popular imagination, said Noreen Malone. Wall Street financiers long held the throne as symbols of greed and excess. But now the young, moneyed entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley appear to be usurping it. Part of the reason is that, like finance before it, tech has become the aspirational career for ambitious young people, which engenders resentment in the less ambitious. And unlike their banking counterparts, the tech set revel in their visibility, especially on social networks that encourage flagrant displays of enviable lifestyle. The villains of finance were openly cynical, proud to be despised, and more than happy to admit that they're just in it for the money. But tech founders tend to think that they're saving the world in addition to getting wealthy, an attitude that can rub white-collar grunts the wrong way. Yet however much that incessant self-aggrandizement rankles, a serious backlash against rich techies hasn't materialized. Outside of the tech press, Americans broadly don't hate the tech world in critical masses. After all, unlike bankers, it provides something they value. People love their iPhones and their internet. At least for now, that matters more than any negative coverage they might be reading. Here's a short one. Millennials take parents to work. Should you bring your mom and dad to your job interview? Asked Anita Hofschneider in the Wall Street Journal. Companies are used to seeing workers' spouses and children, but now employees have started bringing new guests to company socials. Mom and dad. Millennials are closer to their parents than previous generations were, and some firms see parental involvement as a way to hold on to talent and boost employee morale. Northwestern Mutual, a financial firm in Milwaukee, even has managers call or send notes to parents when interns achieve their sales goals. That's no longer uncommon. One recent study found that 13% of college graduates worldwide wanted their parents to get a copy of their job offer letters. And another survey found that 8% of graduates had their parents accompany them to job interviews. Here's an obituary I thought you might appreciate. The repairman who cherished typewriters, Matson Whitlock, 1917 to 2013. Matson Whitlock repaired manual typewriters even when there weren't many left, stubbornly resisting the technology that transformed them from essential writer's instrument to retro artifact. They're not tools of necessity anymore, he admitted in 2010. Kids are buying them on the internet. Is that what it's called? Whitlock began working in the typewriter department of his father's bookstore in 1930, said the New Haven, Connecticut Register, finding a lifelong outlet for his innate tinkerer's urge. After fighting in World War II, he opened a typewriter repair shop of his own and worked there, often 7 days a week and usually in a coat and tie, until his death. Although he was too modest to talk about it, he repaired typewriters in New Haven for the great and good, for former President Gerald Ford to the writers Robert Penn Warren and Archibald MacLeish. A lifetime of repairing 300,000 typewriters left Whitlock with two fingers permanently curled from gripping a screwdriver, said the Washington Post. His shelves were stocked with ancient Royals, Remingtons, and Underwoods, constituting a kind of private museum of a once ubiquitous machine. Watching over it all was a bust of Mark Twain, whom Whitlock honored as the first author to submit a typed manuscript to a publisher. Although Whitlock acquiesced to repairing electric typewriters in the 1970s, he remained too proud a Luddite to march any further into the modern age. I don't even know what a computer is, he said in 2010. I've heard about them a lot, but I don't own one, and I don't want to own one. Over on the health and science page, the befuddling effect of poverty. The strain of worrying constantly about making ends meet depletes poor people's brain power, making them more likely to make bad decisions that can perpetuate the cycle of poverty. In fact, Princeton University researchers conclude in a new study, just feeling poor can quickly knock 13 points off a person's IQ. To determine how financial worries affect thinking, the researchers posed various problems to middle and low-income shoppers at a New Jersey mall. The study subjects were asked to make decisions about how they'd spend their money when facing emergency expenses. When the expenses were large, the cognitive performance of the poorer shoppers fell dramatically, by an equivalent of 13 IQ points or a lost night's sleep, while the better-off shoppers' scores remained the same. Picture yourself after an all-nighter, said co-author Sindel Mulathan, tells the Washington Post. Being poor is like that every day. Researchers also ran cognitive tests on farmers in India before their harvest, when they were financially strapped, and afterward, when they were flush with cash. They, too, scored worse when they had less money. There's been a perception that the poor function less well, said Elder Shafir, the other co-author of the study. But when you don't have enough money, it occupies your mind and takes away bandwidth that you could use for other things. A grand hidden canyon. The world's longest canyon lies buried below 2 miles of ice in Greenland. Researchers discovered the unknown geographical feature by examining data collected from airplanes equipped with ice-penetrating radar. The radar revealed a massive gash in the island's bedrock that is twice as long and twice as wide as the Grand Canyon, though only half as deep. It's not every decade, it's not every five decades that you discover something quite as substantial and extensive as a feature like this. So it was a big surprise for us. Geographer Jonathan Bamber of the University of Bristol in the UK tells NPR.org, "The canyon appears to funnel meltwater from Greenland's massive ice sheet into the sea, which may explain why there are no lakes beneath Greenland's ice, as there are beneath Antarctica's. The runoff may also influence how quickly sea levels rise as climate change causes ice to melt on the world's largest island. Researchers believe rivers carved out the canyon some 4 million years ago. You think that everything that could be known about the land surface is known, but it's not," Bamber said. "There's still so much to learn about the planet." Growing a human brain. Austrian researchers have used stem cells to create human brain tissue in a petri dish, a breakthrough that could help scientists study how complex disorders like autism and schizophrenia develop. Stem cell researchers have previously grown tissue from other organs, including the heart and liver, but the brain, one of the most complex structures in the universe, has remained out of reach until now. The Austrian team used embryonic stem cells and adult skin cells that they reverted to stem cells to form pea-sized structures with different brain regions, mimicking the brain architecture of a 9-week-old human embryo. "It's a long way from consciousness or awareness or responding to the outside world," said neurologist Zamil Kadir of the John Radcliffe Hospital in the UK, tells BBCnews.com. "Still, the ability to grow human brain tissue could allow researchers to watch for the first time how neurological diseases develop, offering clues to diagnosing and treating them before symptoms appear." "What our organoids are good for," said researcher Jürgen Noblitsch, "is to model development of the brain and to study anything that causes a defect." Over to the talking points. Syria, the end of U.S. interventionism? "Sorry, President Obama, the American people are tired of being the world's judge, jury, and policeman," said Jeff Foe in the HuffingtonPost.com. "The president and members of his administration spent the past week urging Congress to authorize a limited military strike on the Syrian regime in retaliation for its use of chemical weapons on innocent civilians. But the American people and their elected representatives have made a stunning show of opposition to yet another foreign intervention. Polls show that 63% of voters are against striking Syria, compared with just 37% who opposed U.S. intervention in Iraq in 2003. The anti-war mood is echoed in Congress, where both Republican and Democratic House members were overwhelmingly opposed to any attack, even before this week's Syrian offer to hand over the country's chemical weapons to UN inspectors. This war weariness was inevitable," said Michael Cohen in The Guardian. "Since September 11, 2001, the American people have been persuaded to back wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, and each time we're told that a quick intervention would give birth to a flowering democracy. The result has been quagmire after quagmire, trillions of dollars in cost, and tens of thousands of dead and maimed Americans. In rejecting a strike on Syria, the nation is showing that it has finally learned not to buy the war maker's tonic." "This new isolationism is understandable," said Bill Keller in the New York Times, "but it's dangerous and short-sighted. Isolationism is not just an aversion to war, which is an altogether healthy instinct. It is a broader reluctance to engage, to assert responsibility, to commit. And as shown by our nation's last experiment with isolationism in the 1930s, when America's firsters argued that Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany wouldn't bother us if we just ignored them, it's also deeply naive. The planet is full of murderous dictators, some of them armed with chemical and nuclear weapons, said Tom Rogan in NationalReview.com. They're only kept in check by the ever-present threat of U.S. intervention. If Iran senses that we're no longer prepared to enforce the global prohibition on chemical weapons, it will go ahead and build nuclear bombs. North Korea's Kim Jong-un will feel free to resort to nuclear blackmail against South Korea, Japan, and even the U.S. Is this the future isolationists want? Is this stability? But interventions, even limited ones, rarely produce stability, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. Take Libya, where U.S. and NATO air power helped topple dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi in 2011. The rebels we backed turned out not to be the natural Democrats many in the administration had claimed. Since Qaddafi's overthrow, the country has lacked a functioning government, with power wielded mainly by a group of militias left over from the revolution. In that chaotic hellhole, al-Qaeda-aligned terrorists now operate with impunity and gave us Benghazi. In Syria, there are also no good guys, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. Its civil war is primarily a sectarian showdown between the repressive Alawite minority and Sunnis, some of whom are radical jihadists. What could we possibly gain by taking sides over which sect should run a crumbling French colonial remnant? It would be like walking into a bar in a foreign country, seeing a brutal fight going on, walking up to the party slugging it out and saying, "Why not hit me instead?" Whatever the U.S. ultimately decides to do in Syria, said Gideon Rockman in Financial Times, it really can't afford to retire from its role of global policeman. The U.S. has acted as the main protector of international security since 1945. It may have made a mess of Vietnam and Iraq, but its intervention in the bloody civil wars in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s was a success, ending a spasm of ethnic cleansing and setting up a lasting peace. Syria may not be so easily subdued, but the problem is that Obama drew a red line over the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons. America's red lines underpin much of the world's security architecture. They discourage China from grabbing Taiwan, disputed islands in the East China Sea, or other neighboring territory, and protect Eastern Europe from Russia bullying and Israel from its hostile neighbors. If the U.S. doesn't succeed in enforcing its red line in Syria, every one of our allies inevitably will feel less secure. The world relies on the American policeman more than it realizes. College football. Should players be paid? It's time to pay college athletes, said Sean Gregory in Time. That's been obvious for years, and became even clearer this month when football season kicked off minus its most captivating player, Heisman-winning quarterback Johnny Manziel. He was banned for half of Texas A&M's season opener for breaking the spirit of the amateur game after allegedly autographing memorabilia for a five-figure fee. But a glance at the multi-billion dollar business that is modern college football shows there's nothing amateur about it. Manziel works a full-time job making tens of millions for his school, his coach, whose salary tops $3 million, and a local business without seeing a penny of it himself. In an era when TV networks are paying billions for the rights to college games, establishing a small wage for college players, say $30,000, isn't just fair. It's an ethical imperative. College athletes do get a wage, said John Tamney in Forbes.com. It's called a scholarship, and it is worth up to $200,000 in tuition, room cost, and expenses. Your average student would kill for a free ride through college. And thanks to college sports, the athletes who hope for pro careers get specialized training and highly visible platform on which to promote themselves and land million-dollar contracts in the NFL. A star like Manziel gets to carry around the marketable name for life. But what about Manziel's teammates, said Joe Nocera in the New York Times. Most will never make it to the pros, and most of them are required to devote so much time to football that they often do not get a real education to fall back on. The scholarship system isn't ideal, said Jeffrey Dorfman in Forbes.com, but a wage scheme would create a nightmare of complications. Will the paychecks be equal, or will the star quarterback who sells the tickets and boosts the TV ratings be paid more than the third-string long snapper? What would stop the 10 or 20 richest, most successful colleges from buying virtually all the best football and basketball players? What happens to the 90% of college sports programs that already lose money? And will the women's lacrosse team get a cut? If not, schools had better lawyer up to defend the Title IX suit for equal pay. Face it, paying college athletes in the name of fairness will just create new problems. Social media. Now, even babies tweet. Harper Estelle Wolfill-Gosk has 6,282 Twitter followers, said Joe Cosarelli in nymag.com. She's 2 weeks old. The infant daughter of Today Show correspondent Jenna Wolf is just one of thousands of kids who have Twitter accounts that are written in their voices, but are set up, maintained, and authored by their parents. Here's a sample of little Harper's tweets. Pooped and peed on doctor's changing table. Everyone laughed. Why bother with such twaddle? Blame both everyday parental pride and tech-savvy paranoia. Many parents feel it's essential to snap up Twitter handles and Gmail accounts for their kids before someone grabs those names. Once those accounts are established, parents can't resist the temptation to put wisecracks in their kids' mouths. Some critics are calling this oversharing, sharing too much information about kids online, said Eliana Doctorman in Time.com. One study found that 94% of parents post pictures of their kids on the internet, with newborns uploaded to Facebook an average of 57.9 minutes after birth. You won't find my daughter there, said Amy Webb in Slate.com. My husband and I have decided we will keep all photos of and references to her off the internet until she's mature enough to decide what to post. Exposing your child on social media poses huge issues for his or her future self. Do you really want photos of your five-year-old in a bathing suit circulating permanently on the internet? Do you want Google and Facebook to start compiling data about your kids before they can even crawl, to be shared with advertisers or intrusive government agencies or unknown searchers? It's inevitable that our daughter will become a public figure, because we're all public figures in this new digital age. But it should be her, not us, who decides what's in that public identity. So parents, please spare us, said Mary Elizabeth Williams in Salon.com. All these babies tweeting and posting supposedly amusing observations on Facebook really is a bit much. It's like we all woke up one day in a mass version of Look Who's Talking. Children are not meant to be a witty accessory to your own online life. Besides, said Katie Weaver in Gawker.com, making sure your kid has the right handle on a Facebook and Instagram account 20 years from now is laughably short-sighted. It's likely to be as useful as 1990s parents stockpiling CompuServe screen names and laser disc players. And a few briefs as we wind down. A psychiatric hospital in Pennsylvania has launched a 10-day inpatient treatment program for people with severe internet addiction, the first of its kind in the U.S. Dr. Kimberly Young, the psychologist behind the nonprofit program, says that internet addiction is more pervasive than alcoholism. The best IN investment in recent years has been vintage automobiles. Prices for well-kept luxury automobiles from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s have more than doubled in the past 5 years and have risen by 28% in the last 12 months alone. Fine art, once considered a safe haven for wealthy investors, dropped 6% this year. Here's one for our audience. Iowa grants gun permits to blind people. State officials concede that being unable to see what you're shooting is not ideal, but say that failing to grant the permits would violate the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. Other states do impose a vision requirement or require applicants to take a field test to prove that they can hit a target. And one of my favorite quotes showed up in the Wit and Wisdom section today. It's from Eleanor Roosevelt. You wouldn't worry so much about what others think of you if you realized how seldom they do. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.